Hey now, it's Mike Gilbert, host of the Mike and JD Show, right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Join JD by God Oliva and myself every Thursday night live on the Voices of Wrestling YouTube channel at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time as we stay up all night discussing all the hottest stories in professional wrestling. You can also check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting feed, or you can subscribe to the Mike and JD Show feed. Now, enjoy the show.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hey there, Thunder Buddies and Travelers Down Thunder Road. It's us, Days of Thunder, the WCW Thunder Rewatch podcast that you didn't ask for, but we did anyway, coming to the part of the Voices of Wrestling podcast network and powered by LargeManAppears.com. I'm your host, the One Ring on Thunder Road, Dave Ryan, and I am joined, as always, by my faithful co-host, Stagger Lee Malone. Lee, how are you this week?
I'm good, good. Feels like a very short turnaround between shows this week, so it's like... We've actually only been talking, like, what, three days ago?
Yeah. We don't want to bullshit y'all with the inside baseball of, haven't seen you in ages, buddy. And it was, like, two nights ago that we recorded our Patreon show for this week.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, just as a plug for largemanappears.com, for five Europeans, I think one of my favorite shows we've ever done.
I think...
In terms of, like...
Absolutely, my favorite Patreon show we've done.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of, like, I don't know. I think I might have had more crack doing, like, maybe the Jesse Ventura story or something, like, more fun doing some of them at the movies shows. But in terms of, like, the content we watched, especially wrestling wise, I don't think we've had a better show. Like, because we watched a selection of six matches picked by our friend and yours, Mark Buckledy of Must See Matches. We did a Must See mixtape of matches that, by and large, we hadn't seen before. And we just gushed for about an hour and a half about our new favourite wrestler, Dump Matsumoto, and a couple of other great highlights in that. So if you were thinking about a month to sign up, that's a pretty good podcast to start with, that's fresh up there. So that's my plug out of the way, shameless as I am.
Speaking of plugs, I think we should plug our new Blue Sky account as well.
Oh yeah, you're bringing us into the brave new digital horizon. Are you sick of posting about us on X?
I didn't realize it was changing name to X until this morning when it was all over Twitter that the X thing was happening, and I was just like, okay.
Well, it's funny because you say it's changed to X, but it's still Twitter.com. Everything still says Twitter. The button still says tweet. The only thing that's really changed properly, as far as anyone can see, is the logo.
Desktop logo, isn't it?
Yeah, the desktop logo. Like, he tried to change the logo on the building, but the police stopped him.
Okay, so yeah, the story is they tried to change the logo. They began taking down the Twitter logo.
Yeah.
And Elon, in his infinite wisdom, had not got any permits to have this done on the street.
Yeah. And if you've... I don't know if you've ever been to San Francisco, Lee, and seen where Twitter's headquarters is.
I have not and have not.
Okay, it is in the middle of the busiest street in San Francisco. So it's not like, it's not an easy spot to get a bunch of like cherry pickers and stuff to pull down a massive Twitter sign. You're going to cause disruption, permits or no. It's very funny just a classic example of like when you get to a certain level of wealth, there's a delusion that takes over and you don't understand why you can't do things.
Yeah, I think the perfect description is that you don't need to be smart when you're born on Tord because, hey, shit just happens and you don't understand how the world actually works. But yes, anyway, we are on Blue Sky. It's at wcwthunderpod.bsky.social.
Mm-hmm. Really rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
It's not ideal for doing plugs, but look, it seems to be the forerunner at the moment of the Twitter replacement apps.
Yeah, we're still, for people that don't know, we're still unable to get a Threads account because Threads is unavailable in the EU.
Is it?
Yeah. it still has to go through some, like, I don't know if it's like data protection specifics or whatever, but it still has to go through a certification process to be available here. So our UK friends and our US friends could be threading it up left, right and center. And as soon as we do have access, I probably will, seeing as I usually do the Instagram stuff, I'll set us up on Threads. But don't hold your breath because the EU does not move at a pace that we would consider ideal. That's for sure.
I had no idea that the EU had no Threads access. So that tells you how much I use Instagram. So
social media maven, Liam Malone there. Lee, I just wanted to check in with you as well. We are, as we are recording this, a month away from All In Weekend, which is set to be our first time seeing each other in person and also our first wrestling show either of us have gone to in 3.5 years.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful that in 3.5 years from now, the half of this card won't have been banished from wrestling like the last card we went to.
Oh, yeah. The last card we both went to, just, it's not worth speaking about, is
it? Yeah, well, in certain terms.
I remember even at the time, it wasn't a great show. And then
I can't even remember what was on the card, but I do know a lot of the people that were present were less than
for sure.
Good people. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not sweating what the card will be because I have every faith that AEW are going to put on a great show. I'm more just looking forward to being surrounded by good friends and having a good time at a wrestling show for the first time in 3.5 years.
Yeah, I think AEW have this habit of like, they don't build pay-per-views in a way that I would if I had the book. Sometimes everything feels a bit like last minute. But it has been a long time since they've put on a pay-per-view where I'm like, well, that was not worth my time at all. You know, the most recent pay-per-view was like a little bit like, not Forbidden Door. The most recent was it Revolution?
It would have been Revolution before that, yes.
Yeah, where I was just like, look, it wasn't, you know, firing on all cylinders 2021, 2022 AEW. But like, it's still, you're trying to remind yourself that like, it's still more enjoyable and accessible than any WWE show I've watched in a long time. It's like, even when I get down on episodes of Dynamite and Collision, I'm just like, I need to remind myself that they have set themselves a very high bar so that even a disappointing one of them is still better than anything I've got from the other crowd in ages.
It would have been Double or Nothing. I'm just looking at the calendar.
Double or Nothing, that's it.
Revolution was early in the year.
Revolution rocked.
Had the Iron Man match.
Yes. I'm really excited for that. Hopefully, send off in the tweets or whatever if you're a Thunder buddy and you're going to be at Wembo. And if you do see us, please stop us, say hello. We'd be happy to have a chat. I'm looking forward to meeting some of our Voices of Wrestling colleagues in person for the first time as well. And to see some friends we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, so it's going to be plenty of old and new faces to meet at, over the course of that weekend. And hopefully, a couple of us will be taking in some English Football League action at some stage as well.
Yeah. If you're somebody that's traveling from abroad or from far away, there is a good bit of football on in London that weekend. So, like, no trip to London is complete without going and seeing, even if it's like absolute dog shit lower league football. Like, there was a time I traveled to London about 12 years ago, and the only game that was on in London was Barnet versus Macclesfield. Genuinely the worst game of football I've ever seen in my life, but I had a great time.
It's not always about the football on show. It's more about the time that shall be had enjoying it.
Yes, the community, isn't it?
Yes.
Around it. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Just about a month to go, and I'm certainly like counting down the days in work for sure to when I get to take that big weekend off. Look, we've held off enough, Lee. Shall we get into this episode of Thunder?
Let's do it.
This is Thunder episode 72 from Moline, Illinois, Mickey J's hometown, the 22nd of July 1999. Got us a 2.6 rating, which was a big jump from last week's Wednesday Thunder, up by 0.5 in the ratings. So I know it's often been a talking point of live versus taped, but you can see that even when it's probably more so a thing back in the 90s, I would say that when something becomes regular appointment viewing, you know, it's in this time slot, it's every week, it's part of my habit, it's part of my must see TV list. Mm-hmm. When you move the time or move the day, big drop, regardless of content.
Yeah, a lot of people have trouble understanding that things do change time or channel or day depending on other events going on in the world. And it just seems to be wrestling especially suffers from this. People will not change from their routine to keep up with a show. But like somebody was talking about the Collision rating this morning, and they were saying, oh, that's, you know, a big rating and a big what's the share, the demographic, demo number. And I was like, well, maybe, like, I know it's only been 5 or 6 weeks, but you have to assume that already there are people that are just in the habit. Saturday night is now just Collision for them.
Saturday night is all right for fighting, you might say.
That's exactly. But wrestling fans seem to be creatures of habits more than any other species of fan that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and I've even noticed a bit of a trend that there is, like, it's not as big a dip, but there's a little bit of a dip sometimes when it becomes apparent that it's not a live Thunder. And I think that's another thing that, like, it was coveted a little bit in the 90s. Wrestling wasn't so much included. Now wrestling is included in that, like, any sort of live television has this kind of special quality to it as far as networks are concerned, because it will, anything that's live will pop an additional X amount of percent in a rating as opposed to something that's taped.
It's the FOMO. People hate to miss out on something live. Like, I mean, I'm the same. I can't watch back a football match. I cannot record a football match and then, like, 3 hours after it ends, go sit down and watch it.
Yeah, if I was somehow able to avoid the result, I might be able to. But you're right that we're so conditioned by sports that, like, you watch it live or you watch the highlights that night. Mm-hmm. You don't watch the full thing after the fact when you know what happened. It's funny to try and apply that logic to wrestling where, you know, like, it's worked, you know, but it is true. There is a certain element to that. Like, if you didn't catch it in the moment and you weren't there to experience it as a live phenomenon, it is kind of...
You missed the magic.
Less special. Yeah. But anyway, this is the first, congratulations, Lee, this is the first show of the Sting presidential reign. Do you feel different? A whole new world has dawned. Do you feel like we are never going to have a struggle for power again?
I'm glad that finally the power within WCW has been consolidated onto one man, finally, and we can put to bed the... any aspirations that anybody else had of making matches, and having any power. It's all about Sting now.
It's all about Sting, and as we all know, until the dying day of WCW, Sting would remain the president.
I'm not sure he makes it through Monday.
I don't know how long it goes, but it's so short that until the match happened on Nitro, I forgot that Sting was ever the president of the company. And I was watching around this time, so it's not like I came to it after the fact.
I just wish that Sting was more of his TNA self at this point, so we could have Sting and full face paint showing up in like a half suit wrestling gear kind of combo.
And could his would his bird have been the VP?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, it'd have to be, surely. Tanae says, they do the bit at the start where Tanae is running down the show and Larry has to go get his kudos, but they kind of have to work it that the fans are calling for it. Tanae is like, you can't deny the people, Larry, but people weren't really chanting for Larry this week.
Two people going, Larry.
Yeah. Yeah. May have been members of the Zbysko family, cannot confirm.
It may have just been the production hands, just like, We have to let him have his fucking moment.
Larry, I'm not letting him off the hook for this, says during the opening bit where he's like, it's great, like, a new day has dawned. The men who deserve title shots will get them. I was like, it wasn't that long ago. It was only a couple of episodes ago where he was like, these young jobbers, fuck them.
I mean, he pretty much changes his attitude as soon as Flair comes out in the main event.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolute snake, this lad. Our main event tonight is Dean Malenko versus Ric Flair. So the idea is Ric Flair is not present anymore, so Sting is going to make him suffer by putting him against the people he's been trying to dodge and play the numbers game against this whole time, starting with Dean. Our opening encounter is a classic put two names in a hat and pull them out. Of Van Hammer versus Kaz Hayashi. I have to say that Van Hammer has added a baseball cap to his look with his singlet, which I don't know why, Lee, but it makes his outfit about, I don't know, 20% more lewd, because it's like wearing the baseball cap accentuates the fact he has no pants on, and don't ask me why, but it does.
Yeah, I can't be the only one that notices how close to the crotch his singlet ends.
Mm-hmm. Like, that is a high line.
His attire is basically 99% toy.
Yeah. He sat backstage with the WCW seamstress and he goes, I'm looking for gear that says I'm a heavy metal professional wrestler, but also look at my penis. And you know what? He achieved that goal.
And to be fair, it does say across his stomach, Hammer. So
yeah. And you know, as a great man once said, the hammer is my penis.
I mean, look, you mentioned it before we started recording. You absolutely loved this match.
You're trying to throw me under a bus here. I didn't love this match at all, right?
You are raving, I would say, over how phenomenal Van Hammer was in this performance.
Remain of my reputation.
Full on, we need to strap up Van Hammer right now.
Absolute sham of a man you are. No, what I said was, this is the most aggressively fine, passable Van Hammer match I can remember. So on the Van Hammer scale, it's 5 stars, because a possible match that I can't give out too much about is way beyond my expectations for Van Hammer in 1999, I have to say.
I mean, you're praising his work, his hat.
His penis.
I mean, I get the feeling he's Van Hammer has replaced Mike Enos for you.
The Van's Hammer alert.
Van's Hammer. Listen,
there's your episode title.
You need to own just how much you were into the Hammer right now.
What happens is, and look, Kaz Hayashi, like, of all the guys you could send out into a squash, like, I was kind of making fun of, this is just two random names, it's such a weird, but, like, Kaz is such a talented wrestler and bumps around and makes people look like $1 million, that if you're going to have, like, an opening squash match against somebody, like, much as I think Kaz should be in a more prominent position, this is a pretty good guy to make you look good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would have to be some kind of sucky wrestler not to have a bit of shine against Kaz. Like, I'm trying to think, maybe the only people we would be down on in a Kaz Hayashi match at this stage would be like Rick Steiner or, in your case specifically, still at this stage, Fit Finlay.
Yeah, probably.
We get a big gorilla press slam from Van Hammer straight off at the top of the match, which is incorrectly. Tanay was having a strange night at the office for calling moves wrong, because he calls this a power slam, which was very disappointed in the professor here. Although this is before he gets his doctorate in wrestling, he's still just Iron Mike Tanay at this stage, I guess.
I mean, look, you've had your first taste of Scott Hudson. Everybody else is going to be compared to that now.
Is it that, like, Hudson's got his time on TV now, so everyone else is rattled and they're off their game?
I'd love that to be true.
This guy's coming for my job. So Kaz gets him down, but Hammer does the classic monster spot of, like, getting covered, but then pressing the guy off and out of the ring at one. Hammer just manhandling him in the corner, whip, corner clothesline, dumps him out to the floor, runs him back first into the apron. Hayashi kind of, like, takes a while to recover, but pulls Van Hammer down to the floor through the ropes, runs in, hits a snapmare and an elbow drop. I was actually surprised that Van Hammer is capable of taking a snapmare bump. I don't know why, I just thought a man that big and awkward would, like, snap both hamstrings.
Well, I mean, we see later on somebody that doesn't take a snapmare bump, so we know it's not the members of the power plant aren't exactly well trained in this kind of stuff.
No, one of the, like, what you would imagine would be
a basic maneuver.
Wrestling skill. Yeah, it's like you're doing running the ropes, tackle drop down, and snapmares. Like, those are, no one can fuck that up, right? Standing elbow drop from Kaz, but it doesn't keep Van Hammer down. Huge beel off the top rope and then clubbing blows to the chest, and then does the kind of, like, the pulling at the face bit, but it really looks like Van Hammer's doing a gotcha nose on Kaz, which I really appreciate. I'd love a wrestler doing a gotcha nose bit as a regular shtick. Kaz fights back with boots and punches. And then I think maybe one of the biggest pops I got all night, the classic, like, smaller man in a match, feeling his oats a bit too much. Kaz goes to powerbomb Van Hammer. And has got a great reaction from Mike Tanay and a great reaction from the crowd.
I have to say, I'll give them credit. The crowd were into this match.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, what's funny is, like, he went to go for the powerbomb, and the crowd bought that he was actually going to do it.
I don't think that could, like, be possible.
Yeah, it was very much like a precursor to the Hurricane choke slamming, like, people like
Big Show. Yeah. Like, the dynamics of Kaz trying to powerbomb Hammer, I don't think Kaz could, like, maneuver a person as long and gangly as Van Hammer.
Yeah, I think if he got up on his shoulders, his legs would still be dragging.
Yeah, like, I don't think it would work.
Yeah. Hammer easily back body drops out of that. Kaz gets another opportunity, hits a missile drop kick, goes for the senton, but oh man, this was a, like, you have a bruised tailbone level of commitment to the senton. He broke his hole on this. He really fucked himself up. He just, like, he goes for everything on this senton and just bounces off his arse on the mat.
I always forget that Kaz's finish was a senton.
And that a senton like that, a very basic senton, was still a high spot at this time.
Yeah, it's odd. Like, it's a at the time, it's still a high risk maneuver, shall we say. But looking at it now, it's just like Kaz is supposed to be one of the top cruiserweights in the world, and he's doing a fucking senton.
Yeah. Van Hammer hits him with an Alabama Slammer type job. He does some big poses, hits his Cobra Clutch Slam and wins. Weird that, like you said, not the only unusual snapmare spot on the show, but he's also not the only wrestler using a Cobra Clutch Slam on the show. The agenting in WCW, once again, impeccable. He wins, and as I wrote here, not bad, which is pretty much the most you could expect from Van Hammer, and then some at this stage.
What did you think of Van Hammer's little moment in the camera after the match?
What was it he was saying?
He says, Cobra Clutch. Once you meet it, you never forget it.
I mean, to tell you what, I could see that slogan on t-shirts up and down the country. Fucking hell. Next up, we have Lenny and Lodi, who are very badly mic'd backstage, and they're in a panic. They're wondering what they did to deserve this. Sneak preview, guys. They're in a match later on, a handicap match, the two of them against Sid Vicious.
You say Lenny and Lodi are in a panic?
Yes. Indeed, sir. Yeah. Indeed. We get our first of many Nitro flashbacks.
So
tonight.
Many.
There was a lot of them, wasn't there?
So many flashbacks.
I mean, here we actually just have two back-to-back straight away. We have Team Madness imploding with Medusa and Miss Madness turning on each other. Larry on commentary stops all but short of saying Jezebel here. Like, he's hitting all the Jim Ross high spots for a traitorous woman. And then we get the video package of the Dennis Rodman return. And I will say about that, Lee, is like, I wouldn't have done two back-to-back video packages, but at least the first one, you understand why it's in this position on the show, because we're about to go into the Miss Madness match. Fair enough. And then Dennis Rodman is a big star, so at some point during the show, you probably should show your Thunder audience on TBS, hey, Dennis Rodman returned on Monday. This is probably why you should be watching Nitro. But again, it's the placement of them back to back in association with another half dozen flashbacks later on. That's the problem. Rather than, I don't think you would disagree that these are two packages that you should be putting up at some stage.
Yeah, I think if you had to put an easier way of doing it would be do the Rodman flashback first of all, and then do the Mona and Medusa flashback, and then go straight into the ladies match.
Or you could even do the flashback of the women as an inset while the women are coming out.
Very possible too.
Do you know what I mean? Like one of them. But yeah, it's just the positioning of, oh, we've got this amount of time to kill, just dump it here. That I don't appreciate.
Yeah. Right. So this match. Match number two of the night, Brandi Alexander and Miss Madness.
Yes.
This is the first WCW women's match we've had, isn't it?
Yes. I wrote that down. It is the first ever women's match of any description on this show. It's certainly the first women's singles match. I don't know if there was a match that was officially listed as not involving a woman, but the way that the tag rules.
Well,
WCW, sometimes matches just become tag matches.
You had Charles and Gorgeous George.
Well, that was a pay-per-view. I kind of mean on
Thunder. On Thunder itself, yeah, this is definitely the first.
Yeah. We also have another first on this, because I had a feeling you'd catch that one. So I wanted to one-up you with an interesting fact about this match, right? Do you want to hear it?
No, because you're going to one-up me, but go for it.
I am, yeah. So Brandi Alexander has 3 televised WCW matches in her career. All of them are against Mona, and all of them are on Thunder. That's right, Lee. This is our first Thunder-exclusive athlete.
Are we going to make that thing now, a Thunder exclusive athlete?
I don't think the list is going to be that long, but yeah, sure.
like, so they do this match 3 more times before Mona leaves.
So they do it two more times. Yeah, Mona has more matches than that, but all of Brandy's matches are against Mona. All over the next few weeks.
Yeah, because like Molly Holly is like late 99, right?
Oh, I don't think she's that soon.
Well, I mean, the Molly Spike angle is... No, that's late 2001. Shit.
Yeah, yeah. Because, like, she's Mighty Molly during the invasion.
Okay.
So, yeah, she debuts in 2000.
Ah, okay.
Valeting for Regal in dark matches as Lady Ophelia.
So, basically, Miss Madness gimmick.
Yeah, so her debut on television is November 6, 2000.
Okay. Wow.
Where she immediately goes into a short feud with Trish Stratus. So there you go. And yeah, she becomes Mighty Molly in September. So the spike angle is like 2001, and she turns on him then in September.
Fair enough. Yeah, there's so your Molly Holly history lesson.
Molly Holly deep dive there. So yeah, she has more matches coming up over the next while. But Brandy has like she has a handful of dark matches, like not dark matches, sorry, house show matches around this time. I think the majority of which are also against Mona. But yeah, this is your lot for her. I just look it up. Yeah. So yeah. She has 4 house show matches against Mona, where Mona swept her 4-0. And then she has she has this match, then the 4 house show matches. Then we get another match between them in 2 back to back weeks in September. Thunder 81 and Thunder 82.
Okay.
And then that's her lot.
I was just gonna say, I came away from this match pretty impressed with Brandy Alexander. I thought she was pretty good.
They probably should have signed her. But she actually only, now, according to Cage Match, which obviously like some of the really, really small indie feds aren't gonna have absolutely everything. But after she finishes up in WCW, she only has 10 more matches.
That seems very little.
Oh, actually, sorry. She has a WCW Worldwide match against Mona as well in November. So after that, she only has 8 more matches in her whole career. Retires in 2002. But had been going since, I think they said on the show, 1992. Cage Match only goes back to 1994. And again, like women's wrestling on the American Indies in the 90s, I don't know how well the record keeping on that is.
Yeah, I'm guessing it would have been like a lot of smaller NWA shows and stuff like that.
Yeah. But she was like pretty solid, wasn't she? And like Mona obviously becomes much better and she's still blatantly green here. But like she's also not bad. Like it's for what I would have expected from how WCW treats women's wrestlers. And how women's wrestling was at the time, by and large, in America. I was expecting this to be a lot worse.
I hate to do the comparison, but compare this match to what you were getting on a Raw or SmackDown with, like, Sable and Tori and, Jackie was obviously a good wrestler, but was having to put up with a lot of crap. Same with Ivory. Like, I thought this was a pretty solid match.
Yeah, like, I have no... It was unspectacular, but... That in and of itself was quite something for this day and age, and it wasn't like a something for the dads kind of match. They weren't like it was. It's funny because it came up on Twitter this week. People talking about like the old like pudding matches and stuff like that. So it wasn't anything that was meant for men to leer at or anything. And it's funny because like the match starts and it's a really cool effect that Miss Madness has like a tear off evening gown, which firstly reminded me of the Hot Cops in Arrested Development, but secondly, like it's basically to reveal evening gown style wrestling gear.
Yeah, it's like the top of her evening gown was actually a singlet.
Yeah. Now, the only thing that would have made the reveal better is if when she had torn off, she was wearing, like, wrestling boots. Like, she had kick pads and stuff underneath. That would have been great. But she wrestles barefoot against Bryony Alexander, who's, like, yeah, just like you said, just fairly solid. Gives the impression of being the veteran here. And the other thing that I was surprised about for this, because again, it's a 1999 audience and we've heard what they're like with certain gimmicks and certain wrestlers and certain women. Miss Madness was over here and the crowd again was into this.
I was stunned. Like, she's getting Madness chants and everything. It seems to be a thing of we're familiar with this woman and we're going to cheer her on. And it was pretty impressive that they got the crowd into it to the degree they did. And again, I think Brandy Alexander deserves some credit because she was a pretty hateable heel.
Yeah. She, like, I think they started off not knowing how either one was going to be received. And as soon as it was obvious that they were super into Miss Madness, they really, Brandy hams up the heel part. And, like, they're exchanging holes. They're doing actual razzling. You know, there's a great spot in here where Brandy has a Boston Crab locked in and Miss Madness reverses the momentum and nearly rolls her up. There's a gorilla press off the top from Brandy, a sidewalk slam for two. And the other thing that I was kind of remarkable, now don't get me wrong, it's not like this went 20 minutes or anything like that, but it got a lot more time than I would have given WCW credit for trying to give women's matches in 1999.
Yeah, for sure.
I genuinely don't know what the, like, and somebody fill us in, like, how many actual women's wrestling matches have even been on Nitro by now? Because it can't be that many.
You would have had maybe in 95 when Medusa was still taking on, like, kind of the Japanese challenger of the month. You might have got a couple. But, I mean, like, into 96, I don't think you were getting much.
No. And it's not like, and the other thing, I don't want to set an expectation that this is going to be the start of something that's going to develop from this point, because this is a rarity. You know, and it remains a rarity. You're not going to get a lot of women's matches that get time and that don't have a leery male gaze quality to them in this company. So don't have that in your head that this is going to be like, oh my God, there was a women's revolution in 1999 and no one noticed. No.
We're right on the cusp of Miss Hancock, Tori Wilson, and Pamela Paulchuk. And Major Guns all being like the top women of the company.
Yeah, yeah. The only exception in the last, like, 2 years of this company is Daphne. And she is, by and large, involved in wrestling men.
And, look, I still think they could add something with Gorgeous George. I'm telling you, I swear a fucking match with Charles Robinson.
Yeah, yeah. We'll stand over that one as one of the essential WCW matches of the era. I'm right beside you on that one, buddy. Head scissors by Miss Madness, and Miss Madness wins with a bridging suplex. I kind of would have preferred if it was like a bridging Northern Lights or something like that. Like, a bridging vertical suplex is a bit of a weird...
I think she was going for a Northern Lights and she just didn't quite set it properly. It was very... Yeah, it was kind of underwhelming for a finish.
Yeah. But it got over. People enjoyed the match. People cheered for her, and now she's very firmly a babyface, and it would be re-established in a segment later on that she is a babyface here. Next up, we have a singles match that was Kurt Hennig with all his lads versus Chase Tatum with all his lads. I thought it was weird that the Cowboy Dorks came out with no music. Like, the thing about them is their music.
I don't know if you noticed this, but it seemed to happen on a couple of the entrances that the music hit very late. And people were like halfway down the entrances by the time their music kicked in. It wasn't just the rednecks that seemed to have production issues.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of weirdness going on in this show from a technical standpoint, I think. Hennig does a rambly promo that references Megadeth, which is, again, so funny for the... We don't want to go on our big rant again. about the WWE Network, but it will be a recurring talking point. But it's funny, like, if you were a young person now watching this and you're seeing multiple people now reference Megadeth and Goldberg, you have no idea what they're talking about because it's all edited off very badly. I did laugh like a little child at how Hennig came up with the incredible put down of calling him Bill Goldturd.
Ah, just class A schoolyard name calling.
Yeah, he also, I don't know if incorrectly or he's trying to go for a bit of a rebrand, refers to them, his group, as the West Texas Outlaws.
Yeah, maybe the redneck thing wasn't popular with the guys, I don't know. But, I mean, I just refer to them as the rednecks, so.
Yeah. He calls Goldberg out, sets the challenge for Nitro. Chase comes out. He overpowers Hennig a couple of times early. I love the tone of surprise in Mike Tenay's voice that Chase was capable of doing a hip toss. We then find out that Mickey J is from Moline, Illinois. Larry takes the opportunity to call him fat again on commentary. I don't know what the fuck his thing with Mickey J is, but that's the second time in the last month he's just fucking called him fat on commentary.
Maybe just fat shaming him for no reason. Larry's just an asshole. I don't know. Yeah. I was just going to say,
in a much better Larry moment, he does refer to 4x4 as the human Hummer, though, and I love that.
What's your thoughts on Chase Tatum? Because to me, he is, alongside Conan, one of the worst wrestlers in this company.
Imagine if Mark Jindrak was 4 times worse. That's what you're like, because he's got the look. Like, he's got the look of, if this guy could go, he would be a world champion.
I think.
But he looks like he just found out before he came out that he has limbs.
Like, I don't think he can sell at all.
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, his selling is so embarrassing. It's like, again, like Conan, you drew the comparison with Conan. Conan is fucking Misawa compared to this guy.
Like,
In terms of wrestling,
Conan moves in slow motion and like doesn't register things properly. Chase Tatum has no idea what he's doing.
No, and Conan, in spite of his many limitations, which we go into detail quite frequently about in this show, one thing we will never take away from him is that guy can still work a crowd even when he's just not doing it physically.
Oh, I mean, look, up until like 2004, the guy was still over in TNA. Probably 2005. The guy was still able to get over. But like, Kurt Hennig, I don't know how he just didn't fucking walk out on this match.
Yeah.
Like, Tatum is the guy we referred to earlier on. Cannot take a snapmare bump. And then when he does go over, I mean, it's Kurt Hennig. Everyone knows snapmare, neck snap. That's what you do.
Yeah.
And Tatum literally just rolls to his knees. And how Kurt Hennig just doesn't fucking kick the shit out of this guy.
Yeah.
He just refuses to sell. He does this kind of drunk stumble thing, and every time Hennig either puts him on the ground or knocks him down or whatever, he instantly springs back to his feet and starts throwing body blows. That's his idea of selling.
Could you please explain to me, because I watched it twice and I still couldn't understand what was happening in this submission spot.
I think this was when Hennig's frustration really, really reached boiling point, because Hennig just really snaps on a kind of leg, like knee bar style move. And Chase Tatum decides that this would be the ideal spot to do a crossface. It's the only way I can describe. His hands are locked. His hands are kind of intertwined over Hennig's eyes.
But he's directly behind him as well. So he's just like, it's almost like a camel clutch while he's lying on his side.
Like, we just did the Mussy mixtape, and you were raving over, was it Funaki and Nakano that did the dueling knee bars.
Yes.
And how both guys were just like, fuck you, my knee bar is better than yours.
Yeah.
This was not that.
This was, he didn't know what he was doing, and Kurt Hennig was so overwhelmed by how bad this guy was, he needed a minute to think. So they both grabbed each other and just sat there.
Like, I genuinely mean this. Kurt Hennig has all my respect in the world for not just trying to fucking boot this guy in the head.
Yeah. Chase, it's...
I just got to say, it has to be like just so frustrating to be a Kurt Hennig and like the history he has in the business and to be put in the ring with a guy like this on TV.
Yeah. It's real bad. Chase hits a power slam. Hennig knocks Chase out. The seconds then start to brawl awkwardly. Swole then gets in. And Jesus Christ, you want to talk about like... like trying to make chicken salad out of chicken shit. Like then you have Swole coming into the clearing. And Swole does the biggest telegraphed, I'm going to give you a heart punch ever. Like... Kurt Hennig has about 10 years to move out of the way of this heart punch. He hits Chase. Kurt Hennig hits the Hennig plex on Chase and wins. And I was kind of personally upset by the inference that Kurt Hennig needed an assist to beat Chase Tatum.
Can we now like finally talk about how the No Limit Soldiers are fucking dead as an act?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll let you talk about that, but the one point I want to make is Kurt Hennig in this match is maybe the one time I'll ever say this about a WCW wrestler. Whatever he was being paid, it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I can agree on that one for sure. Look, I think the No Limits Holders were kind of dead on arrival as soon as he started feuding with the Rednecks, because the Rednecks got so over that they should have been pushed as faces. So...
yeah.
Like, feuding with the rap guys in, you know, Southern America was never going to work. And, like, look, Rey Mysterio has already kind of moved away into his own thing. Conan was not ringside with these guys.
Master P is nowhere to be found.
Yeah, it was BA, Swole, 4x4, and Chase. I'm sorry, that's a Saturday night fucking team.
The No Limit Soldiers B team. Like,
yeah, and it's like a month into the run.
Yeah. I would actually take the NWO B team over them.
Oh, listen. Horace Hogan is fucking Kenta Kobashi compared to any of these guys.
I love that we've hit two of the four pillars in this one segment. Great bit.
Scott Norton. Is Toshiaki Kawad Vincent and all. I can't do it.
yes. Sick boy. The Tawei of
somebody, yeah, somebody will get real mad if we compare somebody to Tawei.
Yeah.
Oh man, so shit.
So we then get another segment of Lenny and Lodi. They're hiding backstage from Sid. I did laugh at they asked Jimmy Hart for advice, and Jimmy Hart says to have a doctor ringside because he's going to fucking kill you. That was good. I like that.
Why didn't Jimmy try and recruit them to his first family?
Or for another hardcore invitational, who's to say? I could have actually stood to see if the skit with Lenny and Lodi had been, they do it for about 10 seconds at the start of this, like Scooby-Doo style, Sid Vicious is looking for them backstage and they're popping in and out of doors, that would have been very good comedy.
Yeah, I think Lenny learned a lot from Jericho, he just didn't learn enough for his backstage skits.
Yeah. Sadly, we get a triad flashback, and this leads up to a triad flashback several segments before the triad are involved in anything. So another just, we're putting this in to pad out in between matches. Our next tag team match, I was like, oh boy, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio versus Hoovy and Psychosis. Lovely stuff.
Okay, so this is, we had an instance of this a couple of weeks ago as well. This was the best thing on the show and still very disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those where they're leaving stuff on the table. They're not going as hard as they could. They don't get the time they should. But still, while we have it, it was very enjoyable, especially relative to the rest of the show.
It feels like they went out there and they were told literally at the curtain, okay, you've got 4 minutes. Or like it doesn't go long. No. It begins, we go to a break, they come back, and it ends within, I want to say, like two and a half minutes after the break.
And you want to talk about, like, the crowds are telling WCW that they've happened upon something here.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction that Eddie and Ray together are getting should have been a, like, warning sirens going off that there's money to be made here. And yes.
Like, we just came from a flashback where we're getting a Harlem Heat tease. And you have Psycho and Hoovy, who are doing nothing at the moment, who absolutely could have ruled as a tag team.
Yeah.
And Eddie and Ray. I mean, what are we doing here?
You keep both of them together as long-term tag teams, and you give them each like a little bit of a push. And you've got a very fun tag division, like revitalized.
Throw them
right
in
there
alongside Saturn and Malenko. All these guys can work.
That's some good shit, and that's keeping everybody happy and busy as well, and on your TV. So there's some nice chain wrestling early from Hoovy and Ray. Eddie tags in. He does a cool, like, helps Ray leapfrog the ropes to do an acai moonsault to Psychosis on the outside as we go through a break. When we come back, Psychosis has the heat on Ray. Big face buster from Ray and a hot tag. And one of the, like, look, we have about 100 different ways across the run of this podcast praised Eddie Guerrero, and we are going to do as much of it as possible for the rest of 99 while we've still fucking got him on the show. But one of the things I don't think we've talked about yet, usually Saturn is the guy we rave about for
hot
this.
Tag Eddie.
Eddie Guerrero, great hot tag guy.
Even in this little match, literally my notes are hot tag Eddie rules. Like he just comes in and is fucking a ball of fire. He just nails anything that moves, and the crowd are they're into this. Eddie hasn't made a face for 3 years at this point.
And they were trying to keep him a heel when he came back, but like he was just too over.
Yeah, the whole like after the post LWO thing and his was it the car crash he had that put him out?
Yeah, he came back from the car crash and he was the LWO hunter.
That's what it was. Yeah. But yeah, like the fans are into Eddie.
The Sakuraba of WCW.
Here we go.
Just for a cope with his Manny.
Oh, God. We're going to get in so much trouble if anyone listens to this.
Has anybody... I think I stand alone as saying we're the only podcast that has inadvertently compared the LWO to the Gracies.
I don't think that's a comparison that has ever been made and ever will be made ever again.
I'm proud of that one. But there's a great spot in here that I think, like, again, if you push this team and you held this off even longer, it's funny because we're seeing a version of this like uneasy alliance between former rivals happening on AEW at the moment with Cole and MJF. But there's a bit here where, like, we know that the alliance is tentative between these two guys, and you don't need to do a lot to make the crowd go, oh, are they going to turn on each other? Because there's a bit here where Eddie gets cornered after his House of Fire hot tag, and Ray is trying to save him by doing a big running Superman punch into the corner, but the heels duck out of the way, and he hits Eddie. And there's a moment there where the crowd are like, oh... But then the baby faces get back on the same page. They overcome them. Eddie boosts... Oh, this was a class finish as well. Eddie leapfrogs Ray up to the top rope for the Frankensteiner. It was... Just, like you said, it wasn't... They left a lot on the table. It was disappointing relative to what they could all do. But I still had a great time while it was happening.
Yeah, like I said, best thing on the show. But ultimately left me disappointed. Because when this match came... came on the screen, I was like, okay, this is getting at least like 15 minutes, and it didn't.
You put this on a pay-per-view and give it 20, and that's like a match of the year candidate in 1999, surely.
To be fair, if this match got 3 more minutes, it probably would have been a 1999 match of the year contender. In North
yeah,
America,
yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, a great
it's not been
year.
A high bar, yeah. Is it? No.
And
no.
Speaking of...
Great year for business, not a great year for professional
and
wrestling.
And speaking of not great, this next segment.
Oh boy. So Savage comes out with Miss Madness and Gorgeous George. And Gorgeous George, I don't know how you describe it, but it's like the most impractical outfit she's had yet. Like, we've had a lot of Team Madness in outfits where they better not take bumps or something is going to explode. And this is one where it's like, well, George had better not be getting physically involved here, because there was like duct tape and hope that was all that was holding this outfit together.
Like, even getting into the ring was probably a stretch for what she was wearing.
She had one of Buff Bagwell's enormous top hats.
A umbrella.
Yeah.
And
I thought it was a cane at first, and I was like, do you know what? Like, if she was doing a nerdy reference, if she did like a Zatanna gimmick in 1999, it probably would have looked good with Savage, but that's not what she
was. I think
going
it was like
here.
A Cruella de Vil style thing. Because like the
yeah maybe
she had the like the Dalmatian spots,
yeah.
I don't know. There was very little clothing involved. That's all I can say.
Yeah, this is much more like this was almost trying to overcorrect for how professionally they treated the women in the match. Where it's like, okay, now the dads need something to ogle at. Is the very much the tone of how this segment came off. So we are reminded that Randy Savage had promised he's running for president. So he says that everyone's going to vote for him in November, and then he lays out the challenge to Rodman. Sturgis. He then alerts us that he officially fired Medusa, demonstrating that he's not afraid to make a decision. He congratulates Miss Madness on her match earlier, but then strips her of her Miss Madness title, saying that there will be another competition for a new Miss Madness. He says that she's been causing confusion in his matches because he is the center of the universe. And then Lee, again, very dodgy, menacing man belittling a woman and cornering her. I did not like this.
I don't want to say he puts his hands on her, because he like very lightly cups her chin, but it's like, it's not good. And like you say, it's menacing and intimidating, and he makes her beg.
Yeah, get down on your knees and beg. He's holding your chin to do the look at me while I'm talking to you kind of thing. Like, it's not good. It's not good. And again, you would think after the send for the man that they would be trying to stay away from this as much as possible. But like, I'm kind of, even for WCW, I'm kind of mouth agape that they're leaning into it.
Yeah. Look. At least the act is now down to George and Savage, and we get less of this.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. This part of his character winds down, because it's just not good.
Actually,
he fires Mona.
I don't know this, and I haven't looked it up, and I don't recall it happening. Do we get a blow off to the Miss Madness Medusa feud?
I can check that for you now. It's not something I necessarily recall, but then again, like we've outlined, it's not like WCW put that much of an emphasis on their wrestling. So we go to Molly Holly's matches. Go all the way back to 1999. Jesus, this makes me feel old now. So we're in July now, aren't we? So I don't see
Okay. I see. They have a singles match in 2000 on Worldwide. They have they do have a blow off, Lee. They have a New York evening gown match in October.
A New York
evening gown in October. Match. And you may say, oh, obviously they were in New York for that show. No, Philadelphia.
But it's in October, and it's called a New York evening gown match. I wonder who's arrived in the company.
Yeah, I know, right? speaking of which, the only other time they come face to face that... Actually, sorry. Oh my God. I think we might need to quit the show, Lee. So they wrestle two more times in 1999, both in December, both the same week. On Thunder, so we do definitely have to watch this match. It's the incredibly strange team of Evan Courageous and Medusa versus Mona and Jeff Jarrett.
Okay, Evan Courageous and Medusa were a thing and feuded for a while and then were a thing together.
Yes.
I remember that.
Yes, because 4 days later, we have a World Cruiserweight title number one contendership triangle match. Medusa versus Evan Courageous versus Mona.
I had no memory of Mona being involved in that. Where does Jeff... You know what? We'll get to it.
Unfortunately, we'll get there. You're right we'll on that. Medusa is also involved as a special guest referee twice in Mona versus Ronda Singh matches in 2000.
Yeah, because I think Medusa goes through a stage where she's a referee as well.
Yeah. Good shit, man. Good shit. WCW.
I definitely have memories of Medusa as a referee, so I'm pretty sure that's a thing that happens. Like, for a couple of weeks, I think Russo makes her a ref or something.
So if you want to call the New York evening gown match a blow-off, you
I don't.
Do that,
I don't but, want to call it that, Dave.
Because if you call waiting 3 months and then doing that as a match that's, like I said, like 2 minutes long, a blow-off, fair enough. But yeah, I would say no, they don't blow off.
I'd say somebody blew off watching that match and bro...
It's wild, though, that, like, you would think, like, and you would be right to think that, like, a logical company, you shoot the angle where they turn on each other. They both get fired, so they've got heat with each other because they've lost their spots because of each other. And now Mona is wrestling on TV, obviously, to get her reps. You would assume for a match with Medusa. And it just doesn't happen.
They just did a flashback of their feud.
Yeah.
It's fucking WCW, man.
Do you want to cheer yourself up by talking about the World Television title match, Lee? Rick Steiner versus Sick
Boy. Yeah, it was short. It was great.
It was like a minute and a half long, so that there's that. Rick started the segment. He was fucking moaning on the microphone for longer than he was wrestling. He challenged Goldberg as well, and I'll tell you, what a fucking stack of challengers Goldberg has in front of him at the
biggest
moment.
Biggest star in the company. Let's put him with Kurt Hennig and Rick Steiner.
Yeah. Kurt Hennig, who you may recall, Lee, he was feuding with in very early Thunder episodes. Like, as soon as Hennig arrived, he was picking a fight with Goldberg when he was... I think he was still US champion at this point.
No. It was...
Oh, was it before? Or was he already world champion?
Yeah, a little. Hennig was the first world title challenger. Hennig had lost like multiple times at this point already to Goldberg.
Okay, so this is their third feud in a year and a half.
Basically.
If they go down.
I think Hennig was his feud right before he won the US title.
And look, if I'm Goldberg, I'm not complaining. Like, you've got... Even a washed Kurt Hennig is an easy night at the races for you.
Absolutely. And Hennig, like, wouldn't have an ego when it comes to... Yeah, just let... Once it's safe and doesn't hurt, great.
Yeah, if the other option is wrestle Rick Steiner, I'm going to Kurt Hennig 100 times, you know.
To be fair, I have some morbid curiosity to see Goldberg no-sell Rick Steiner.
Yeah, yeah, and if Rick tries any of his shit with Goldberg.
Because I think if there was one person that was beyond being fucked with by the Steiners, well, it was Tank Abbott and Goldberg.
Yeah. Legitimate tough guys. So, Larry had a good line in here during Rick's entrance where he says, if you got bitten by Rick Steiner, you'd need an awful lot of antibiotics, which I laughed at. Sick boy in his new look, looking like fucking Kmart Dolph Ziggler. His slick back, dyed blonde hair and tiny silver jocks. Don't care for it. Look, there's no point in going move by move. It's a minute and a half. It's the typical Rick Steiner match. He takes liberties with a guy, roughs him up, even though Sick Boy was cooperating with him. There was no need to rough him around like that. Steiner Bulldog on a win. It was absolute shite.
Yeah.
I literally don't care about Rick Steiner.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, we talk about, as we did during his last match, we enjoy hard-hitting physical matches. We enjoy matches where sometimes the difference between real and fake gets a bit blurred. There's nobody who gets less heat from actually stiffing dudes in professional wrestling than Rick Steiner. It's incredible.
And I genuinely, like, this TV title in 1999 has just been, had an awful existence.
Yeah. And then you pair that as well with, like, it feels like every week now before we record this podcast, there's more reminders that, like, Rick Steiner's a terrible human being. Yeah, so it's not even like, you know, he was going through a bad patch, but he turned out to be a good guy. No, he was awful then, and he's awful and now.
You now also have the WWE fans retconning going, oh, well, WWE knew not to use the Steiner name.
Yeah.
Fucking morons.
Fuck off. Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of moronic.
We get a promo for Berlin.
Yes. I like how can you describe this?
It was very much like, did you get the feeling, because it's using like historical archival footage from 1989, the strong inference that Alex Wright ended the Cold War exists in this promo.
I mean, I've always believed historically it was David Hasselhoff and Alex Wright that brought down the wall.
Dancing atop the atop Berlin Wall like Kimono Wanalei. We'll all remember the night that Hasselhoff and Alex Wright danced atop the Berlin Wall.
Shirtless, the pair of them.
That's the Hoff brother.
Oh, God. I mean, even the slogans that flash up on the screen make no sense in the context of this.
It was like a graphic from Brass. It just like, it felt like a fucking parody.
I tell you, if WCW could have got Phil Collins to put over Berlin, I'd have been into it.
Yeah, look, I would have been.
Yeah, like you say, you have all this historical footage of the wall being knocked down, and you just get these like, what is it, no victory, like as in KNOW. Yeah. No victory. No defeat, as in NO defeat. And then Berlin. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. How long would you say before Berlin debuts from now?
6 weeks.
You almost have a bang on. Yeah, so this is the 22nd of July, isn't it? And he debuts on the 12th of September. He debuts
and he's repackaged in October.
We get like Berlin. I suppose he's still Berlin, but the Berlin is getting tweaked repeatedly for a while. until I think the first appearance of the wall in competition is in November. But there's some real bangers coming up before then, I'll tell you. And we do get a good
Berlin and what's Dustin Rhodes' Creepy Pedo 7?
Seven.
Aren't those gimmicks like in around the same time?
God, when does the seven thing happen? Is it? It must be. It 99, is 99, is it?
It is, isn't it?
God, it's. I have it so blocked out in my head. I'm so heartbroken at the idea we're going to eventually have to talk about that. Yeah, so he returns on November 8th.
Yeah, so they just miss crossing over paths.
I love Wikipedia here. The character was dropped after Turner's Standards and Practices expressed concern that the gimmick could be misinterpreted as a child abductor.
I mean...
to be honest, a child abductor is probably...
I don't know where the,
on the mild
misinterpretation
side
will be.
I'd be far more worried that people were interpreting it wasn't abducting he was planning on doing to the children.
Oh, man. And people blame Standards and Practices for the fucking downfall of this company.
Yeah.
There wasn't enough of them, if you ask me. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's your Berlin promo. We get a flashback to the alliance possibly forming between Kevin Nash and Rick Steiner. Then we get, I think one of my favorite characters in professional wrestling is NyQuil Nash phoning into Thunder instead of actually being there.
Oh, no, he was there. He was backstage. He just couldn't be in the arse making an entrance.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like, I suppose, quote unquote, not there. He was allegedly at a bar in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
He's asking somebody to put lime in his drink in the background. He's challenging Sting and Hogan versus him and a mystery partner. And he says, Lee, this is a mystery partner I've known for 9 years. And I'm talking to him right
in
now.
In a bar.
Do you know who the mystery partner is?
Well, I know he's teasing Scott Hall.
Yes. It's Sid. Who is distinctly not in Scottsville.
See, okay, so...
Scottsdale even, sorry. He's in the next match.
he says he's backstage, like, before he does the mystery partner thing, he says he's, like, with a good friend of his that he's known 9 years. I was fully prepared for him to say it's Rick Steiner, despite the fact that Rick Steiner was in the segment before.
Yeah, they show you the thing to make you, like... Rick Steiner would have made more sense because they show you the video. And yes, you're right that he's clearly implying it's Scott mm-hmm. Hall. Right? He's trying to make you think it's Scott Hall. But at least after the video and after what happened on Nitro, if next week it's Rick Steiner that shows up at the mystery partner, you're at least like, that makes sense. Because Sid Vicious makes no sense at all.
Well, apart from the fact that Sting and Sid are feud.
Yeah, no, that, yeah, in as much as, like, let's just stick him with the guy he's feuding with. But I don't know why it has to be a mystery partner that's a mate of
No, it literally should have just been, yeah, Hogan, you get Sting, I've got Sid.
Yeah. But he, like, he's so, shall we generously say, sleepy on this phone call that he's just not putting it over in a way that's exciting whatsoever. He says he doesn't like this idea of Hogan all of a sudden coming back and being Mr. Nice Guy. He says he's going to drop him like a bad habit. Then we get what I think is exactly what a squash match should be, Lee. 2-on-1 handicap match, Lenny Lane versus Lodi versus Sid Vicious. The cowards are immediately killed extremely quickly.
I think you need to get into the habit of saying Lodi and Lenny Lane because, of course, they are brothers. So it'd be very unfair to say Lenny Lane and Lodi. Yeah. Yeah, this is perfect. So it's a couple of moves, wins.
Yeah, there's Cobra Clutch slam on Lenny. Lodi eats a powerbomb, and then he's just like, fuck it, I'm going to powerbomb Lenny as well. And then, like, Lenny leaps on top of Lodi to defend him in 69 position, would you believe?
Yeah.
And Sid does a 1 foot stacked pin on them.
I like Sid.
It was a perfect squash apart from the gay panic.
I like Sid, so it's fine.
Yeah. Then we get another flashback. Flair and his pals screwing Dean on Nitro. Which leads us into our main event, which is Dean Malenko versus Ric Flair with Asia. This felt like it was going to go longer than it did, Lee. And it starts off teasing the idea that there might be like a flash finish, because pretty much right after the bell, Dean nearly locks in the Cloverleaf. But what did you, I suppose, without going hugely back and forth on the play-by-play on this match, because I don't think it was anything special, personally. What did you think of this? This is like our first attempt. This is our first a chance to maybe see Evil Flair get some comeuppance.
Yeah, it's like the match was fine. Like you said, it's nothing to write home about. I don't get this sense, apart from other than it being in a match with somebody he's been feuding with, that this is any different than when Flair was in charge. Like,
there was one spot that I thought was a very clever bit of storytelling, and that's where he tries to intimidate Mickey J, and the commentators do a really good job of putting over. It's like, oh, it's not his man in the ring anymore, so he can't just push referees around and tell them what to do now. So I thought that was a very good show of how his safety has been taken away from him, and, you know, we might finally get to see a just finish in one
of
these
matches.
I
did have a funny thought watching this match. So,
okay,
in 1999 and 2000, Ric Flair... Well, 98 and 99, Ric Flair very much surrounds himself with Benoit, Malenko, Arn. Like, he wrestles a very small number of people. DDP. Like, he kind of, his feuds are very repetitive. Piper is in and out. It's funny to me that then when he gets to the WWF, all of a sudden he's Shawn Michaels and Triple H's best friend. And yeah. I was just thinking, like, in an alternate universe, is Ric Flair not so much remembered differently within WWE's history, but would it be a thing of he wouldn't be lauded as much if he just remained kind of loyal, shall we say, to the Benoits and the Malenkos of the world?
Yeah. That's an interesting one, like, because the thing, I suppose, that got him a lot of cred when he made the jump as well is, like, him being a hero of Triple H's. So I think even if maybe he hadn't been all buddy-buddy, the fact that, like, the top guy, one of the top guys in the company is, like, a massive mark, like, for Flair.
Obviously, it helped that Triple H wanted to do his all NWA stint, and he had his, like, Harley run in 2003, and he wanted Flair to...
Don't fucking talk to me about
Flair
that
to be his JJ and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was just... I was just watching. I was like, it kind of just dawned on me just how surrounded Flair was by his friends in the company.
Yeah.
And that when Saturn, Malenko, Dean and Eddie left, Flair actually lost a lot of allies.
Yeah. And, like, we will be chronicling for the next 2 years nearly on this podcast how, like, it's already kind of being stamped out of him a little bit, but, like, he has remarked himself many times about how by the end of WCW, he didn't know who Ric Flair was anymore, and he didn't have a passion for wrestling anymore. And they've definitely done a lot of work towards that already by 99. But let me tell you guys, there are some doozies coming up. We haven't even gotten to the desert yet.
I'm looking forward to that. I don't know. Maybe it's more with curiosity. I'm kind of looking forward to just how they just come back from that.
I'm really excited for this period of time as well, because like, as we've chronicled on the podcast, is like, the further we get into this, the less you've actually seen in their entire angles, and the more I've seen. So I'm going to start enjoying myself more as time goes on, and you're going to start enjoying yourself a lot less. And I'm personally going to be very happy about that.
You like to see me suffer, what can you say?
And myself not suffer as well. That's a key part of the equation here. After the Flair begging Mickey J spot, Flair is doing the like hiding behind Asia as a human shield thing a couple of times. He goes for a sucker punch, but Dean thinks fast and nearly rolls him up, but Asia is still distracting Mickey J. So Dean gets the visual pin, but not the actual pin. Malenko hits a clothesline, which like Larry is really eager to point out isn't something you see from Malenko that much, throwing a lariat. I'm like, okay, it's not something I'd ever noticed him do or not do. So you do you, Larry, whatever. Flair gets annoyed now and tries to bail. Dean is giving chase, but Perry and Benoit in their dress casual wear come out and cut him off at the ramp. The triad then come out and attack Benoit and Perry, but crucially not DDP yet. Dean knocks down Asia, another woman getting bumped by a man on WCW programming again. Brilliant stuff. Well done, lads. And as that happens, DDP finally makes an appearance, runs straight into the ring. Malenko has the cloverleaf in on Flair. DDP attempts to cut her, but Dean stuffs it, bumps him into Asia. Asia bumps again off the apron, and Flair rolls up Dean. The one thing I will say about this finish is, Lee, this wasn't a taped thunder. So where the fuck was Shane Douglas?
Yeah, I was watching, I was like, I know this Thunder wasn't taped the week, though. Why did they have the hot debut and then all of a sudden he's not there for his guys? It made no sense.
Yeah, because like, now I know they didn't, do you know what I mean? They didn't refresh the Thunder audience's memory by showing Shane's debut. So maybe I should have inferred from that that they had no intention of him coming out. But having just watched the Nitro, and knowing that he's part of this group now, and hearing him heavily imply that he was coming after Flair, like, your mind immediately puts two and two together and is like, okay, so all the heels are you know, beating up Shane Douglas's buddies. This is the exact moment where you want Shane Douglas to get, like, physical for the first time, make the run in, save, babyface a stand tall, even if Flair is after getting the roll-up win. And it just doesn't happen. The heels win, stand triumphant, and we go off the air.
Yeah, it just fucking... I don't want to say cutting it off before it gets going, but yeah. I know on Nitro, because we had a bit of confusion about which Nitro to watch, that we do get a Shane Douglas segment where he calls out Flair.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But yeah, it just seems like a missed attempt here.
It's like they had the beginning point to Nitro. And then they went, oh, well, on Nitro, he's going to do this. And they booked Malenko versus Flair as a way to continue the Flair has no power. And then just totally skipped over the bit where it's, well, these guys are the Revolution now. So they should be a fully formed unit. They should all be together.
Yeah. And it would have been a great way of showing people why you have to tune into Thunder as well. Because you'll miss key elements of a story. But it's the classic, what WCW actually would do in practice is they would hold anything important off until Nitro. Leading you, conditioning the audience that like nothing of any import ever happens on Thunder.
Does it really?
I mean, look, all I'm saying is there's only one show where David Arquette won the world title and it ain't no Nitro.
That is true. We'll always have that first.
We'll always have that. Anyway, that's the end of this particular episode of Thunder. Lee, what did you think of the show overall, and who are your winners and losers?
The show overall, it was a kind of a nutting show. It wasn't bad. I didn't struggle to get through it, but like, it was just a kind of a show that existed. And they're the shows that we've talked about before. They're the kind of the hardest to to talk about. It's like stuff happened, but nothing happened. I don't know. I think the big winners of the show were Ray and Eddie. I thought they just instantly, well, we know they have great chemistry, but just like we said, the crowd were into them right from the get-go. Miss Madness, I thought, had a very good match outing, like a very good singles match. Crowd were into her, and it was just unfortunate that the last we see of her is the Macho Man segment. Biggest Losers. Yeah. Oh, God. I don't know. Us for having to watch Chase Tatum. Actually, the Biggest Losers, the No Limit Soldiers. What a fucking nutting that group is.
Yeah. I'll co-sign as well that, yeah, it is one of those middle-of-the-road thunders where there's not, like, so, like, stuff that's so bad I'm angry about it. But it was a very watchable show. Like, it was one of the easier ones to watch in one sitting that we've had lately. So there is that. Like, nothing was egregiously bad. But then it's not a thunder that even by episode 73 I'm going to remember. So, yeah, there's that too. Right, one last bit of business, and that's the finish counter brought to you by Ludwig Borger, which has 7 matches on this show, 5 clean finishes, surprisingly high number, and 2 with interference leading directly to a finish. Thank you very much for listening to another episode of Days of Thunder. We'll see you again in 1 week on Patreon, in 2 weeks on the free feed here at Voices of Wrestling. Until then, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Days of Thunder. Days of Thunder was produced by Lee Malone and edited by me, Dave Ryan. To keep up to date with the show and find all the ways to listen to us, you can follow us on Twitter at WCWThunderPod or click the Linktree link in our Twitter bio or in the show notes. I am at The Day to Dave on Twitter, and Lee is at Malone_713. Days of Thunder is a part of the Voices of Wrestling podcast network. Follow the VOW network anywhere good podcasts are sold for more fine podcasts than you can shake a stick at. Thanks. Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener, Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.